In Jungian theory, we really look at, like, you have to have a strong ego to be able to do that work. And so folks who have lived through developmental trauma don't have that egoic position to be able to relate to the unconscious, as what you're talking about is supposed to happen in Vipassana meditation. And that's why some people go into psychosis, because there's not a strong enough egoic position to be able to relate to the unconscious material. So the body can be a place for me where we can build kind of a stronger egoic position to be able to relate to the unconscious as well. And so there's no ego to sacrifice if there's no ego that's been developed fully.
Hello and welcome to episode 42 of the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm Ricky DeRiz, and this episode will answer the ultimate question to life, the universe, and everything. Or maybe not quite everything, but I couldn't miss the only chance I get to reference the number 42 from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Anyway, moving on swiftly, Jane Clapp does answer many questions I had about the inner universe. Jane is a distinguished Jungian analyst who formed Jungian Somatics from over 20 years of clinical experience. Exploring the interplay of body and psyche, she specializes in developmental and complex trauma through a mythological and embodied lens. Our conversation includes somatic symptoms as symbols from the unconscious, developing ego strength, misconceptions about shadow work, how skilled guidance can highlight blind spots, dreams as compensating for psychic imbalances, individual and cultural complexes, the tension of opposites and the transcendent function, and the risk, reward, and necessity of differentiating from group mentality on the journey of growth. Just a reminder before we jump into the conversation to please like, rate, subscribe, and share to help more people access the podcast. Enjoy. So Jane, welcome to the Mind That Ego podcast. It's
Thanks
great
for
to have
having
you
me.
here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So I've been following your Instagram page, and I think the thing that has really struck me is bringing in the somatic work to Jungian philosophy, as well as the clarity. I think I mentioned this in the email I sent, the clarity of your mythological approach to problems. So personally, I find it really illuminating and really helpful. I wondered to begin if you could describe or give an overview of Jungian somatics, and we'll take it from there and explore from that point.
In Jungian somatics, we really look at, like, the body as the shadow, but not kind of a deified entity that kind of has flipped in our culture in many ways, where we look at the body as this, like, kind of all-knowing kind of oracle that'll tell you exactly what you need. And for me, I look at the body as an entry point into the labyrinth of the psyche. But with somatic, sometimes the body is treated as an end point through sensation and not necessarily as a doorway into aspects of the psyche that we really aren't aware of. So to me, I saw this term the other day, no, soma pneumatics, where we're really looking at the intersection of soul and body more than anything, or you could call subtle body, but it's this idea in somatic sometimes that we really try to treat the symptoms. But if we don't find a way to symbolize, the symptoms just keep coming back. And that's what I found in my work as a trauma specialist over the years, even before I was working as a Jungian analyst, that people would do all this somatic work, nervous system work, follow, like, polyvagal theory to a T, and were really perplexed and felt more broken by the time they came and reached me, been seeing that all the somatic work wasn't really alleviating their suffering or helping them move through their trauma narrative.
Well, yeah, that's really powerful as well. I know there is discussion or probably argument as well between the value of narrativizing versus going to the body. So in your experience, it's essential to you say, like, when you say to symbolize, could you explain that in terms of what symbol means in that context?
Sure. So when I work with somatic symptoms, I look at them teleologically versus pathologically. So teleological is sort of The idea that the symptom is actually an attempt at self-healing, which, I don't think many people can argue that that isn't true, except that if we can't find a way to access our deeper self with a capital S in Jungian terminology, I'm not sure that we are actually getting to the heart of what's trying to drive our healing process. So there's this idea that the psyche is a self-regulating system. Psyche equals soul. Soul does not speak in words. Soul speaks in symbols. So the language of the soul is through symbols. So the symbol has a really potent healing potential that also contains affect. So it's sort of like we can keep focusing on somatic symptoms through sensation, through kind of nervous system language, but we don't get to the point where we can actually hear in a different way, where a soul continues to work on us and through us and guides us into what our soul is trying to tell us.
Wow, that's beautifully put. I really
I'm
like
glad. Don't ask me to repeat
that. Get in
that.
flow. This is what we want. We want you to flow your genius through. That's what we're aiming for. Something that comes to mind for me is I've been exploring a lot the relationship between the overlap of meditation or meditative practices that, this idea of, say, Vipassana, or in the Yoga Sutras, where you work with sensation, but the idea of getting to the root and associated practices of concentration, equanimity, all related to not getting caught up with content. So stepping back from content, allowing a bit of freedom between the content and awareness of it. And the relationship between that and then the Jungian or the symbolic and how they relate. So to hear you say, it almost like the sensations alone, they're half of the story, but you need a almost a personal mythology to interpret its place, would you say?
Yeah, well, if we think of in Jungian terminology, somatic symptoms are really at the deepest layer of the unconscious, what we would call the psychoid unconscious. And that's kind of the realm where archetypes live as well. But a lot of folks kind of stop at sensation without allowing the symptoms to rise up in a level of consciousness, and that comes through symbol oftentimes. So when we're working particularly with trauma, a lot of people want to like move forward into this deeper work relating to self, Vipassana. But the idea is like the sacrifice of the ego, which is a really important aspect. But for folks who, because I really specialize in developmental trauma, in Jungian theory, we really look at like you have to have a strong ego to be able to do that work. And so folks who've lived through developmental trauma don't have that egoic position to be able to relate to the unconscious, as what you're talking about is supposed to happen in Vipassana meditation. And that's why some people go into psychosis, because there's not a strong enough egoic position to be able to relate to the unconscious material. So the body can be a place for me where we can build kind of a stronger egoic position to be able to relate to the unconscious as well. And so there's no ego to sacrifice if there's no ego that's been developed fully. And so it's sort of like, well, with developmental trauma, often what happens is what's called the ego self access hasn't really started to emerge properly. And what's taken over is sort of archetypal survival resources that come in when we're very young. So there's these really intense archetypal energies that have come in to help us survive beyond our capacity as children. And then they sometimes take over our lives. And so the work is really gently to build an egoic position to be able to look in the dark. But if you're already in the dark, you can't really have a place to look into the dark from,
Yeah. So many
That help?
questions. Yeah, of course. This is personally the topics for me that are so potent and rich, and the way that you describe them is, yeah, it's now setting off so many threads. So I'd like to look at, it's a big one, like you mentioned, stabilizing the ego.
Mm-hmm.
There is, it seems, terminology between the Jungian aspect of ego and a lot of these, like
100%.
modern, yeah, like the idea of an ego being annihilated. How Eckhart Tolle, for example, speaks about the ego, it tends to be more egoic, would you say, like in terms of a behavioral trait?
Well, I was thinking about this before I was going to speak with you today, and I'm like, how can we frame this? Because I think in some Eastern traditions that the ego is actually more a word of like super ego in Freudian terminology, or like a persona. But when we think of ego in Jungian terminology, it's sort of like consciousness head command center. And so its job is like reality testing over time, helping you form a sense of identity, continuity of narrative. So it's sort of like the command center. It's not our entire personality, but we kind of need to be able to have this place to relate to the unconscious from, or else we can get swallowed up in it. So ego isn't, there's this idea in Jungian work that second half of life, it's sort of you are meant to build an ego to be able to sacrifice it in second half of life. So we do need a sense of self. We need to create, we need an adaptive persona in the outside world. Like, persona is not bad. It's only when we start to believe we are our persona. And so that's like kind of the nuance there. So yeah, but ego side is a term that some Jungians would use, but that can be kind of annihilating of one's sense of self in the world. Like, it's really tricky because some people want to fast forward this process, and I just see too many people who get really destabilized by going too deep too fast in an effort to try to clear. And I'm just, whenever I hear that, cleanse, clear, release trauma, I'm just like, oh man. You know, I'm just like, you know, with this.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much, if anything, you know of my background, but like I've experienced psychosis. More, I mean, I don't talk about it in these terms so commonly, but pervasive and quite enduring psychosis. So maybe I've got some kind of schizoid disorder that's undiagnosed, in all honesty, just for how long it's been around. But my experience of that makes me so wary of the power of the unconscious and almost like lifting the lid, because I didn't have that choice. And it's taken me a long time to understand what was going on. And that's my personal attraction to Jungian work. I found Jung and I was like, oh wow, this is describing in a different way what I'm experiencing. So I really resonate with that, like almost the potential for transformation, but also the risk of the unconscious. I think it
It
was
is
Robert
not a
Jordan.
benevolent place. People think, oh, the unconscious is just there to help you. And I'm like, just like the body, the unconscious isn't a benevolent place. It's mixed. Archetypes have polarities, right? So in Jungian work, we don't just look at the personal unconscious where Freud stopped. We look at the collective unconscious. We look at the deeper layer of the unconscious that can press on someone's psyche. And so when you experience psychosis, you have this like extreme, what would be called abaissement du niveau mental, which is a lessening of psychic restraint. So you don't have the filter. And so the ego is meant to be the filter, to be this like, what comes up and what doesn't. And so people want to have really big experiences to get a feeling that things are going to move faster, that you're doing deeper work because you're feeling more. And the body is not a benevolent place. So a lot of somatic practitioners might want to go deep and go feel. And I'm like, just it contains all aspects of the unconscious, including the collective unconscious. So you have to have reverence for it, you know? And it's really difficult to do it alone. You need your Ariadne outside of the labyrinth, right? So, yeah.
Oh god, there's so much here. Because you're also, the thing is, I'm having this conversation and you're responding to questions that I've been meditating on for a while. So I'm trying to
Oh,
kind of ground myself through
good.
that.
Well, look, we're having that chemical reaction, right? Two
Yeah.
people, and it's like, oh, okay,
Yeah, it's really illuminating, and it's like a place for me, because I don't want a friend of mine asked me recently about shadow work, and
don't even get me started on that.
I know that's one of my questions, because I saw your posts on it, and I really keen. But he so I'll lead with this. So he said to me, because of the idea of the shadow, the concept of shadow work was something that for him felt really scary. He's got a background in, let's just say, dogmatic religion, so a bit of conditioning around that, sin, the idea of sin and this kind of thing. And for him, shadow work was something to fear. And he basically said to me, in your experience, is it something to fear? And my response, which I'm now conscious of as I share this, was yes and no, similar to what we describe in terms of there has to be reverence, but there's also treasure there. And what I did say is, in my experience, ultimately the way through, like, a lot of the fear is illusionary. But as you say, doing that alone is, I think even the idea of the hero's journey can kind of romanticize this process a bit.
Well, it's hilarious because you can't do shadow work alone because shadow is what you can't see in yourself. So how can you possibly do it alone? Like people bring dreams to me and they'll have an immediate associations, right? Based on consciousness, often objective reality. But if you actually go into the dream and you have someone guide you into areas that you might not see yourself, I mean, that's shadow work. I'm not sure what people even mean when they say shadow work because it feels like they've taken out a really narrow section of Jung's work and they're like, I'm just going to do this now. And I'm like, well, what are you doing? Because it's this idea that we are in control of the process, conscious control of the process, right? Versus when you're actually in longer term analysis, Jungian analysis, it's very emergent and it's driven by the self-regulating function of the psyche. You can't like, do it. It's sort of like when I hear people saying, I'm doing shadow work, it's coming from an egoic position. And it's often with your friend, for example, in different religious traditions, it's this idea of sort of exorcising the shadow. It's getting rid of the shadow so I can be pure. And so when I hear shadow work, I hear is there a little element of like, a puritanical must get rid of this dark stuff in me so I can suffer less, you know? And people do that with their bodies as well, quite unconsciously. This idea of I'm going to release this trauma, I'm going to release this shadow, and then I'm going to be light, right? So when I hear shadow work, I hear like this actual what I'm hearing is a real pursuit of the light. Right?
Which could paradoxically create its own shadow.
Well, it actually the more rigid our conscious position, the more that the exact opposite is constellated in the unconscious and the body. So if you're meeting, if sh I don't really know what people are talking about when they say shadow work, to be honest. Like, what are you doing, right? Even the word work implies you're doing it, right? And the psyche doesn't work that way. And the psyche is really meant to only give us as much as we can handle. Right. And sometimes things get blown out. Like sometimes that the self-regulating function of the psyche is not available to people, as in when you go into psychosis. So, yeah. I'm not sure what's going on culturally on that front, but. I'm just like, damn, is this an Instagram trend, you know, for some people where now shadow work is like hashtag shadow work? And I'm like, it doesn't work that way. You can't set aside 2 months and just do shadow work. Like, you know,
It's
and not,
commodified, isn't it?
well, it's commodified. It's not just commodified. I think I don't think people understand what Jung meant by shadow when they talk about shadow work. Because there's a lot of anything that's in the unconscious before you start working with it to differentiate it could be called shadow. Right? So where are you going first? You know? And oftentimes the shadow is in psychoanalysis emerges through the raw material, the shit of your life, the prima materia. You know, like I always joke that poo analysts really like poo dreams because it means the shadow, the raw material, the shit, the darkness is becoming available, but it becomes available on its own schedule. Do you know?
Yeah, this is great. So I'll just share and just trust where I'm sharing from and my perspective, because you said shadow work cannot be done alone.
No, you can't
And
see your own back. Like, that's the whole point. Shadow is what you can't see.
right. I'm saying, so I just, for honesty, I'm saying that from a perspective of feeling like I've done inner work with myself, as well as it, I've had therapy, I've got mentors as well. Like, I'm not doing it all on my own. Just want to be really clear about that. But the process for me of, and I'm really willing to be corrected on this, and kind of to see my own blind spot around it. Dream material surfacing and working with that material and trying to integrate. I know it's a mammoth task to attempt to do that on your own, and I've had limited degrees of success working in therapy with that. With that, if the psyche's self-regulating and there's material surfacing from the shadow, is there not a possibility of that being like an inner process? Or do you feel that you always need, like, how do you differentiate that? I don't know if that question or that line
Okay,
makes
well,
sense.
I think if you've been in analysis with a Jungian analyst who is trained in really methodical dream interpretation and knows kind of the process, and there's a certain amount of theory involved, and then you have to leave that out the window. Your dream will never show you what you already know. So the challenge with doing your own dream analysis, if you haven't really done a lot in a structured way with someone who's trained in like really sound and Jung considered himself a scientist as well. Some may argue that he was or wasn't, but some may say he's more of a mystic, but you can't really do it yourself because you can't see. And so it's all about like what are our associations with symbols, right? And we sometimes often go to the first association, but every symbol has polarity. And most people will either go to one or the other polarity, but you need someone to like help guide you to what you don't already see. So I'm not sure you can do dream analysis alone without you need a guide, you know? I'm kind of a believer in that because we stop on our often objective associations with dreams. And most dreams are subjective and compensatory. And in being compensatory, they're trying to show us something that our consciousness can't see.
Is there, I'm sticking with this because maybe my ego is attached to this
Go, go. I love
idea,
it.
but
It's a great conversation.
okay, good. Do you think it's possible to cultivate, like you're saying, if you work with an analyst, it's almost like you cultivate a different way of seeing, and then you can interpret symbolically. I'm really interested in this. Almost like developing a primordial sense of communication and interpreting. I've used the term poetic intelligence before to describe that, where through insight, it's almost like the intuitive function strengthens, so it becomes easier. Even if the conscious ego, if something surfaces in the conscious ego, the ego's got more dexterity to interpret. I don't know if that makes sense. That's I feel something akin to that has happened to me, but I could be, to use the symbol, full of shit. So
I could never say for you what works.
yeah, true.
And clearly you've been deep in your own process for a long time. So I could never say that that isn't the right way. I would just say that people will do almost anything possible to not do longer term dedicated depth-based work. Anything. From name whatever type of somatic or body-based modality you can find. Like people will do almost anything not to that work. Because a Jungian analysis, and I think a lot of this work that is having us look deeper into ourselves beyond the collective, beyond kind of who we think we are sometimes. Some people call it a kind of a safe place for an inner revolution. And I think sometimes I think we need the support to be able to navigate so much of that uncertainty, liminality, dark night of the soul. You know, because if you do
Yeah.
start really embarking on this work, there's a chance you could really hit your own personal dark night of the soul, and you need someone with you in that moment, or you can get swallowed up in the dark.
Yeah.
Right? You really do. So that's why I'm like, shadow work solo. It's like you're going into the belly of the whale,
Yeah.
and where's that spark of light that's going to help you kind
Yeah.
of, you know, that's shadow work is whatever that means, is hard. And I believe we need a companion, and we live in such an individualistic Western kind of culture where we think we should be able to do these things ourselves. And that I'm like, okay, well, we can be in process ourselves. The people who get the most benefit out of psychoanalysis are the ones who are working between sessions. So it's not like I don't agree with self-work. I just don't think that, I think like Jungian analysts and others, I'm sure, are really trained to see in the dark. That's our work, right? So, yeah. So we're supposed to kind of be able to pick up on things in the transference, counter transference, and dreams, and for me, somatic experiences, expressive arts that aren't quite visible. And, you know, in my own very lengthy analysis, which, you know, I'm still in because of the work I do, I'm always surprised by what I didn't see. So it's a humbling kind of process in many ways. Yeah.
I'm one, I imagine that it's almost like exponential. Let's say it is possible to do work alone. If you do have that guide, it's going to have an exponential process. Like it's that understanding is going to be amplified a lot quicker, I would imagine. I can also vouch, like I've in terms of the experiences that I've had in doing I guess I'd call it shadow work, but like you say, not always a choice in that belly of the well experience. I've been challenged to my absolute thresholds, of ability to just to hold what I've experienced. And I know that the spiritual teachers that I resonate with are the ones that generally talk to this. Like they generally will say, if you go deep into meditation, that filter, that lid on the unconscious naturally begins to weaken. And you're going to have all sorts of stuff surface to the extent that there is like a mythological heaven and hell experience. Images of like destruction, annihilation, Armageddon.
Well, more the alchemical phase of analysis called mortificatio, decay, dismemberment, like that kind of. So the challenge is if you have a really intense trauma history, for example, you're going almost into analysis in a mortificatio stage, dismemberment, you know, dissociation. So trying to do that yourself, I mean, you're just going deeper into the hole. Right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, and I've had support. I've got mentors. I've got people. Like I said, I've had therapy as well. But I think without a meditation practice, I wouldn't have been able to get through that. As simple as that, I would not have been able to get through it. And meditation also, increasingly through experience, using meditation to ground in my body. But yeah, I can definitely vouch for that. It's a confrontation with the personal. I know you speak to this as well. I'm interested in how you would explain, like, entering the depths of the self, or like the personal psyche, and within that space, an encounter with the collective unconscious. Because that's something I've heard speak, like Marie Louise von Franz speak about this, and I'm intrigued because I don't. For me, I grasp it, but that overlap and that point of how the collective and the personal relate is something I'm really interested in.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why Freud and Jung split is because Jung really observed the existence of the collective unconscious via dream schizophrenic patients that he worked with for years through their dreams. And he's like, how do they have access to these images and archetypal themes, mythology that they've never been exposed to? And he's like, what is going on? So when we think of co complexes, because Jungian work could have been called complex theory, where complexes are sort of these autonomous, like I call them, like energy orbs or autonomous personalities in the psyche. They have an archetypal core. So I think of like complexes, shadow. Complexes are often part of the shadow, right? We don't often aware of them when they're running. They direct our lives, take over, dot, dot, dot. So I look at complexes sort of like cells, and the nucleus is the archetype. So the battery charge is the nucleus, and then the cell material around it are like feeling, tone, images, memories that are personal to us. But the challenge with trauma is that it's almost like the archetypal realm has been really dominant in someone's psyche. So I'm really reticent to encourage someone to dive into the collective unconscious, particularly when they've already been really living through kind of archetypal energies, survival energies. So, yeah, so the collective unconscious is the, it's for a definition, is modes of functioning, patterns of behavior, you know, that are kind of born anew in the brain structure of every member of a species. And spring is my favorite time to kind of watch how this works when I go by this body of water near my house. We're in Toronto. And you just watch spring, and you just watch how all these animals just know what to do. Right? So it's like there's this layer inside of us. So, but the collective unconscious in post-Jungian is also named cultural complexes. So we have our personal complexes, and then we have our cultural complexes that also press on someone's psyche, sort of press upwards on someone's psyche, and kind of get woven into personal complexes as well. So when I think of Jung's work, he's basically talking about a biopsychosocial perspective on mental health, where systems of oppression, you know, cultural norms, collective pressures to conform can really impact someone's ability to engage in their own individuation process, becoming into being who they really are, sort of like James Hillman's acorn theory.
Would you like to expand? I'm familiar with it, but it's such a cool.
It's cool. Well, you know, James Hillman was more of archetypal psychology, so he would be looking more about beyond the personal unconscious a lot in terms of what drives people in life. So it's this idea that he believes, I'm not saying I believe this, that nurture isn't nearly as important as the sort of soul code that you're born into the world with, that you don't come into the world with as a blank slate, tabula rasa. So it's the idea that an acorn is meant to become an oak tree. And that's kind of our work in this lifetime. So, yeah. And that's more driven by a soul code than it is about nature, nurture. And in the trauma zeitgeist right now, there's so much focus on nurture that I think things have fallen far too open to that direction.
Ah, so many directions.
Take a breath, take a breath.
ground myself, ground yourself, Ricky. So I with Acorn Theory, I wrote about this recently and was attempting to articulate, I guess, to myself. You mentioned nature, a tree innately grows, from that acorn, it grows. We can never say what that subjectivity is like to be a tree, right? In that, and what its consciousness is, or how it follows that process. Humans have that distinct split between the innate, the natural, and the conscious or civilized, we could say. So I was playing with, well, if you have that blueprint, what is the natural growth process? And it essentially, that is what individuation is, right? Like the almost creating more harmony between conscious and unconscious, so your innate growth process can move forward. But then the process of growing operates through, because of the way that we've split and we have conscious autonomy, although that's up for debate depending on what philosophy or approach, but you have conscious autonomy, that it's the direction in which to grow depends on both subjective material surfacing, understanding, intuition, and events in terms of synchronicities, like guidance along the way as this whole process emerges. Feel free to riff off of that. It was just that, like, is it a thought experiment around if you have that blueprint, what does it feel like subjectively to notice, oh, I'm growing in that direction. There's something individual, there's a spark here, and I'm moving in that
Well,
direction.
it's important, like with that, there's progression and regression as part of the growth process. And regression cannot feel good. It's this idea in our culture that growth feels good. And it most certainly doesn't all the time. And so when I think about the idea in our culture of like growing, well, what does that actually mean? Like, are you growing down? Are you growing up? Are you growing your roots? Are you growing, both have to exist at the same time, I suppose. And there's a stages in like a psychoanalysis process when people have to go into the dark. So it doesn't feel like growing and it feels terrible at times. And it can really being in like liminality in between places, uncertainty, knowing where you're going is a really essential part of the process. But when we try to be in a state of growing, we're actually trying to control the process sometimes, which is tricky. And so it's like the ego to the self is the moved to the mover. It's this idea, right? And so, yeah. Sort of what's supposed to happen, how it feels, not always good because the self often in trying to help us move towards who we a sense of wholeness, we have to go through lots of tension. We have to live in tension of opposites and not try to immediately kind of soothe them. We have to live in discomfort. We have to live in uncertainty. We have to live not knowing where we're going next. And those are the natural death and rebirth cycles that are supposed to happen in our lifetime. So I don't know how I would have made it this far in my life without someone holding me in those dark times. Like really, I've been so graced to have support to be able to get through really difficult, dark times where, I had to just be in it. You know?
Just be in it rather than trying to rush through it is sometimes the most difficult thing, isn't it?
And then if we try to rush through it, we try to alleviate this tension of opposites where what's called the transcendent function will emerge organically. But it's this idea that Jung's work is very energic, right? And it's in these tension of opposites, say between your conscious or unconscious, or even intra inner psychic conflicts, where this has to be here. Like this is where the alchemical process happens, and it's hot, it can be hard, it can be. And then the third thing emerges, but we often try to move faster through these things on our own or in other ways that kind of impede the transcendent function because we try to jump out of the tension. And I think about this somatically too, how I'm not suggesting we live with pain unnecessarily, unnecessary physical pain or fascial issues, or but there's this like we're trying to use our body as an alchemical container to hold discomfort, tension, and to be cooked from the inside. Like it's hard, you know?
And all of that goes against convention, conventional ways of thinking, conventional ways of doing, trying to be, trying to control.
Well, look, I was at the first Embodied Young conference in Italy a year and a half ago, and they're amazing practitioners. But there's also this idea that the body is a place we feel good in, or where the feminine principle lives, or and I'm just like, wow, if you've seen the people I've worked with who have such a difficult relationship fully incarnating in their bodies, no way would you be looking at the body that way. It's a tricky place. So we're trying to find what feels good. Like I practice yoga and I'm like open to other being in other people's guidance. But it's that phrase, just do what feels good. Just do what feels good. Just do what feels good. And I'm just like, huh. 'Cause strength training doesn't feel good, right? I was a strength and mobility coach for years and years, working with people in the middle of trauma. To adapt requires approaching things that we don't feel like are quite within our reach sometimes. And I'm not talking about aspirational or Sisyphean or like it's,
Yeah, it's good stress. And I think it's such a beautiful metaphor, strength training, because, and I saw your post on this, which I loved, because I strength train, I get so much from it. It's so much. And the way that you describe that as sometimes allowing you to develop a stronger ego through strengthening the body.
If it's mindful strength training and you're not just like AMRAPing your ass off,
Which I used to do, and I learned my lesson.
because and some people might not know what AMRAP is, but as many reps as possible, that just like powering through, but often overriding what you're feeling in your body.
Instead, focusing on like the mind muscle connection, and how, and I guess it's pushing the body in a healthy way, and understanding what is possible, but also the relationship between the mind and body. Even if it's just, I don't think I can lift this weight, and then feel your body be like, no, I can. You're like, well, what just happened?
And then I would be like, oh, what complex is that an inferiority complex at work in your strength?
I feel too seen right now. My bench press has been stuck for so long. What an inferiority complex.
Or you know what I really love about the way I learned strength training is you're only as strong as your weakest parts, meaning like the parts of our body that need support, the stabilizing muscles, right? Like I studied Charles Poliquin's work, and people probably don't know him anymore, but you were like he was a strength coach to athletes, hockey player, and it's like you have to work on the parts that are not really connected. So what I love about that approach is like you don't just work on the big muscles, you go to the parts of the body that need to be woken up, brought back online, and then you move more efficiently with less effort, right? Over time. But Yeah, so I like that idea of mindful strength training is really helping all the parts work better together.
Such a parallel, isn't it? Which it makes sense from that, from the psychoid and the body being a symbol of the psyche. Like there's that shared dimension, and then body and psyche coexist. Like that makes sense that there are archetypal energetic patterns that reflect between them.
Well, and like people's movement habits or lack thereof, or what movement they gravitate towards, can tell me a lot about how their psyche's operating at that point. And like a lot. Yeah.
I've had about 2 million questions that have just kind of arose and then gone away. But there was one around, like in the body, discomfort in the body as part of a transformation process, as part of alchemy. How, because that's also something that I think a lot of these, like Vipassana and certain practices around mindfulness and meditation, and I don't mean that mindfulness 2.0, like the light version that we see a lot, but really being with sensation and discomfort and experiencing, like holding awareness on it and seeing what happens. Does it start to disintegrate? Does it change? Is there some sense of spaciousness in pain and that kind of thing? But I don't know if you noticed this or not, but I commented on one of your posts on energy in the body and energy as activation or energy as fear, I think it was, or survival or something along those lines, and responded with a question about rage.
Oh, so I think you might have asked me about that. Right. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, because I know I'll just share it in public, it's fine. I'll just go for it. But
Well, it's
the
in public
link,
on social media, so.
exactly. But the reason being, because, and I've had other conversations recently around this, so the last two podcasts have both surfaced the same theme, that the more you connect to yourself, it's almost like you're becoming more alive or more in touch with life. But then it can mean that you surface big emotions, and there can be, in my experience, like the body's adaptability to being with big emotions, which basically translates as a lot of energy. And for me, rage, like there was we've got a history around working with anger and just holding that, like you mentioned, holding the discomfort of it in the body. How that activates all sorts of stuff in my mind, all sorts of commentaries and injustice and so on. But an incident happened at home, which was significant, and I won't go into detail, but it was related to violence and that kind of thing, and I felt incredibly powerless in that moment. I'm away from I live in Berlin. My family are at home in the UK. And I just had that confrontation with rage in this, being with the energy of it. It was just like so much energy. And the difficulty for me was being at home with that, and it, like being within in my body with that energy. And then, and this is where I kind of lead into more of an inquiry, noticing almost, because you mentioned the subtle body. I'm noticing a distinction between a feeling of movement. Like there were movements that my body felt like it wanted to make that didn't correlate to my posture. And one phrase to describe that would be like lashing out. And that's obviously got I judge that at least as wrong or bad. So if my body feels like it wants to lash out, I'm usually going to try and suppress that rather than lash out. So I'm just like, don't lash out. But yeah, just noticing, like, so really to bring that together, that the experience of really intense emotions, and for me, rage is like the most difficult to be with, but I can see how it can be really alive and in, but how to be with the body in those moments. And if for you, That distinction between like the energy body and movement is something that you work with and have noticed. Sorry if that's a bit of a number of things kind of.
No, I gotcha. Well, I've worked with a lot of people who have experienced oppression directly or in the systems that we live in. I've worked with people who have experienced sexual assault, people who have experienced, racism, discrimination. And often what has to go offline when we're having a trauma response are things that could put us more in harm's way, which can often be anger, rage, aggression. Even more so for children who had to sort of split off parts of themselves in order to kind of find ways to attach to caregivers or to experience less violence. So a huge aspect of what can get split off is aggression and rage and frustration for some people. And in kind of nervous system language, the fight response, right? So that can really impact our ability to feel safe in the world if we don't have that available to us, right? And also, these emotions are shadow emotions, and in many spiritual circles, there's this idea that, anger will harm you, and it's toxic, and da 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 da, and like skipping forward to states of forgiveness, which can be really, really, really repressive, and create like a real split between our conscious and unconscious. It's you can't skip over these things. The biggest question is that the difference is a feeling isn't a behavior, and so people who've witnessed a lot of violence. The anger can feel so scary because it's equated to a behavior versus a feeling, right? And then we have things like Wilhelm Reich, who was one of the first sort of really overtly body-oriented psychodynamic therapists, kind of created a practice that was about releasing big feelings, like bioenergetics and that like catharsis of anger. That's really tricky because we can basically be inviting ourselves to become possessed by an emotion in order to release it. But what you're just doing is you're more deeply grooving these neural pathways that can, So when I think about the biggest question is, do you have the rage or does it have you? And so my work has been over the years, how can people's bodies feel like a bigger alchemical container to be able to hold these feelings as information to be related to help us be more discerning and skillful and find ways to have more agency in our lives.
That's an awesome answer. Thank you.
Does that help? I hope that kind of summarizes things for you, but yeah, there's.
Well, catharsis, I had a conversation. I don't know if you're familiar with Judith Blackstone. She's a meditation teacher, but she teaches embodied non-duality. And catharsis came up as a subject there as well, in the same way that there's a risk. And the way that you've articulated, I think it taps into to an intuition that I felt around that, because it's almost like catharsis is the opposite to that Vipassana monk mode of just
Being
be
with.
completely still, yeah, be aware, completely still, let it move through. Then you have catharsis, which is like let the movement just go fully. And at the same time, in my experience, because I've tried doing that whole monk mode thing, and it doesn't
Well, because you
didn't.
know what? You need something. The alchemical process might not be there. So, for example, I'll have people draw their anger. Something called spontaneous drawing, where you just like draw the affect. And then sometimes I'll do like six pictures in 6 minutes. And so it kind of provides a perspective function of the psyche's process. So we have to work with our emotions, not just have them. Work with them, relate to them, try, but not necessarily just white knuckle it either, right?
Yeah, and there's so much, and that's the thing, that there's the potential transformation is that as a life force, anger, rage, embodied and directed in the right way, that can move mountains to some extent. Like when it doesn't have you, but you're like, okay, this is going to motivate me to, and it might even be energizing the intellect to then write a blog post. I don't know. Like however you want to do it, but yeah, that
But I'll often
moving.
people think it's all present day, right? But these so Complexes have feeling tones to them. So they always have an embodied kind of physiological component to them. So, say someone experiences a lot of rage in a present day situation, I'd get curious, how familiar is this feeling? Is there any age that comes up for you? So you try to sort of connect these bigger feelings to complexes so we can see what might be running. Not in a way of making them wrong, but helping us see, like, is there some wisdom in exploring this feeling to see what complexes is really activated? And then mapping out complexes. So our work is like differentiating complexes. And for me, I'm like, how does each complex feel in the body? And it's sort of parts. You can look at it through, like, IFS is heavily informed by complex theory as well. So it's like mapping out your parts. And oftentimes it's really positive for me when there's mindful anger versus anger attached to a helpless victim or a victim punisher complex. So for some people with really difficult trauma histories, a victim punisher complex can really be constellated, and then you're like, then you're in a hole, you're in a vortex at that point, right?
This is a loaded question, but do you see that playing out on the global stage currently, that complex?
Oh, like a cultural complex in terms of victim punisher. Well, yeah, totalitarianism, like people who feel weak often gravitate towards people who are have more power to feel safer, the punisher, right? So a sense of helplessness most definitely can have people move towards more totalitarian leaders for sure. Yeah. So when we feel out of control, well, where do we find a sense of control? We're trying to find a sense of security, safety, certainty, whatever it might be. So, yeah, for sure. It's not a loaded question. It's a great question.
I don't want to go too far down that route, but I don't think it's a coincidence you live in Canada. And that's the question. That's all I'm going to say.
Say more. Like, you think we're peaceful people? No, our cultural complexes are buried. Like,
I don't want to say, I don't want to share too much, but I'm really interested in this kind of like that Jungian depth psychology. I do a series with my friend Nick called Archetypes of Awakening, and we basically translate this like depth psychology to global events. And I agree, not only is that kind of totalitarianism a risk of the shadow, but also, I personally believe that certain world leaders or people in those positions understand that and exploit it. I whether that's just a dynamic in their own shadow of power, kind of craving power creates that. But I actually think that in if you look at historically totalitarian systems, they create a lot of confusion, a lot of fragmentation in the population, only then to say, this is the solution. We're going to unify all the chaos, and here's the solution, and we've got you. And it creates like
Got you.
a yeah, I've got it.
I've got you. It reminds me of what can happen in a family system as well, where the head of the family, whether it be a patriarch or whomever, actually splits, creates splits between the members of the family. Right. And so othering other parts of the family so that they don't really come together. And then they maintain a sense of control because they've divided and conquered the people within the system. So that can play out on the family system level as well. And then they're the holder of the information and the knowledge. And yeah, so for sure. I think we see that with propaganda very much so, right?
Big time. I mean, and the like the dark magician archetype, like people
The
that are
trickster.
the trickster, and how that plays out on like global stage and like you say propaganda, the end the engineering or the attempt to engineer the collective psyche
Do you
through
know
it.
Samuel Kimball's work?
No, I don't actually.
Love his work. He talks about phantom narratives in society and culture, and even within psychoanalysis training programs. He's one of the few Black Jungians who, because Jung's work is fraught in many ways on that front. So I'm post-Jungian, so I'm not classical. But yeah, so Samuel Kimball's does really great work and weighing in on cultural complexes as well. And yeah, it's really powerful. It's included in my thesis. I kind of talk about a lot of this in my thesis as well. So on social media and archetypal algorithms. And the
Samuel
like
Kimball.
that divisiveness and the polarities that get accentuated.
What's it in a nutshell? Sorry to say, in a nutshell, just to
I'm good.
condense and
No, I'm
compare
good. I'm good.
it in a
That call
nutshell,
back to Acorn Theory.
what is the key distinction of post-Jungian compared to pre or
Well,
original?
for me, like there's many different ways of looking at what it means to be post-Jungian, but a key aspect of that for me is taking aspects of Jung's work that need to be adapted to present day and questioning kind of any colonial ideas around race and gender as well that really need to be looked at and brought into present day. The other aspect of post-Jungian, it's funny because Jung really did talk about like the collective unconscious, and he lived through two world wars. Like he wasn't just focused on individual psyche. So what happened over time for me that I've noticed in the Jungian world, it's become more what happens in the consulting room versus like what's happening in the collective. And so there's a bit of a movement in many training programs to bring more of the understanding of the collective in. And Jung was not apolitical, and really. And so to me, it's also bringing in and not being so apolitical that you don't have an opinion about what's going wrong, what the harm that's being done in the world as well. I feel like some Jungians have tucked themselves away, as many therapists have, in trying to be sort of apolitical. And to me, being post-Jungian means not being neutral, not being in a neutral place around what's going on. We're not so elevated above that we can be not somehow included in trying to support people in what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously not, I'm not a Jungian therapist, but Archetypes of Awakening originated from Nick and I experienced, like, just seeing things about the way that things were unfolding on the global stage, feeling a lot of anger, feeling a lot of isolation, because I feel like it was a minority perspective that we were in, reading between the lines, probably clear what that would have been over the last couple of years. But then choosing to be, in terms of emotion, like how can we do something about this that feels productive? And it was part of that. It was almost like an act of grace and compassion. Even like at the level that we're at, and I think of like a lot of analysts, they've got an abundant understanding that as an act of compassion and service for the collective, if you can start to map and highlight these mechanisms globally and politically, that's something huge there. And it not that individual work isn't, but that's the key to significant, like to change from a depth level, not just from the surface.
And Jung really believed that doing our inner work to find our own moral center, our own kind of guiding principle in life, was really the work, because so that we don't fall into the group archetype, so that we don't lose, like, because it's this idea of what he spoke about with mob psychology, that when you're in a group and a mob psychology, the level of consciousness of the group actually falls to the level of an animal. And so he believed like the work in individuation is about like how do we not want to fit in with a collective? And then what hasn't happened in a lot of Jungian circles, it's like, okay, well, who am I and who am I like Doing our deep inner work. But there's this idea that once you engage in your individuation process, which never stops, you're supposed to bring it back to the collective. Just like the hero's journey, which is kind of masculine element, you're supposed to return to the collective and somehow like participate and give back. But we do have to do that. Like, where is my center? Where's my not what I'm being told I should believe in from the outside, but where am I in this? And how do I choose not to participate with collective norms and conform? And then how do you withstand that process of essentially othering yourself?
Yeah, I
Right?
can
How do you
relate.
how yeah, how do you yeah, so how do you withstand that kind of purposely choosing not to fit in?
I look, we, I'm aware you've got to head off fairly soon. I'm gonna, this is a, well, it's not random, it's very much thematic to what we're discussing, but it's something that has been on my mind. I might make an interesting point, but this othering, I think a lot of people that have spiritual awakenings, which you might say is just a quick expansion of the ego, or like, oh, I'm not this person that I thought I was. I've got access to different energies, different like beliefs, what's going on, like a bit of confusion. For like a lot of people that go through that, then actually struggle because it's seen as inherently a good thing. But what happens if the persona, the self-image that you've cultivated over years is then suddenly boom, challenged? Because I personally, I know I'm in an arc of my journey, but I've not got from A to B. That's where I'm at. And A was like a big awakening, the way that I'm being, the things that I'm doing no longer fit. And I've had this like expanse of liminality in between. And I'm getting hints at what point B could be, but it's been a long, I'm talking years, and it's been a real struggle to be like, what does this all mean? How do I kind of rebuild? Question from that is my sense is almost like with the persona, and I'd be in, yeah, just interested to hear your thoughts, like that I almost created, that my previous persona disintegrated. And I actually think at one point I didn't really have a persona, which is why I went through a bit of a like psychotic break, essentially, because that filter wasn't really there. So in Jungian terms, that's how I describe it, that I struggled with that persona and felt too exposed in the world. But at the same time, there was a scaffolding or like a construction, almost like a temporary persona between point A and point B. So I'm interested in, I think the persona is maybe overlooked in pop Jungian psychology. But where am I going with this? Yeah, that was it. So I'm playing with the idea of a te like almost like a temporary construction of a persona to put you in a situation which for me has been a lot more solitude. A lot less social interaction to do certain work or the work to be done on me because it doesn't feel like it was a choice. But now that death and rebirth is that I can feel I had the pain of I'm not who I thought I was, awakening territory. Then I'm compelled to change my life in this way and like another persona that came from that. And now like another function where I'm like, oh, now that part of me is dying. The part of me that sees myself as more introverted and in solitude. And I'm in this space between, well, I guess you could say A, B, and C, the temporary persona, who I was, who I'm becoming, I'm wanting to integrate.
I'm hearing you say persona, but I'm like, there's something that I'm like, it doesn't feel like persona. It feels like some of Jung's work around typology might apply here.
Okay.
Yeah, like it might be helpful to dig into an understanding of typology and inferior function. And like how our typology kind of we lead with our dominant function to begin with in our lives, and then that slowly We're supposed to kind of develop our inferior function when there's a lot of life energy in it, but when we don't, it can get really messy. So, it feels, I'm not, I, because persona is like an adaptive mask that we wear for the outside world, right? So that's sort of the technical definition of persona. So what I hear is like you're maybe bringing, and I don't know you, and you're not a an Allison, but like it feels like you're bringing different parts of yourself back online, kind of like a like more of a remembering, bringing together parts more so than persona. And that's not what I'm hearing. So you're meeting parts of yourself and really experiencing them, and then, you know.
The persona thing for me, which I'm kind of taking that from my limited knowledge, but I had no problems in the past being super social whilst feeling anxiety, whilst feeling like not wanting to socialize, like all of these kind of things. But my persona was so adaptive, almost too adaptive, because if I when I was I had depression, I could then go out and act fine. So I knew that that wasn't serving me.
So that would be like Donald Kalshed's term, I would call the self-care system. So that sounds more like a self-care system, and then your sometimes our self-care system really starts to fall apart. So that's more what I'm hearing, the way that you've adapted to being able to survive your self-care system is really being challenged.
And I think, sorry, I'm like turning this into a personal therapy session now, but
Oh, it's okay.
we don't.
We have 4 minutes. I'm sure we can get a lot of work done together.
You got four. So, like the interest. I'd love for us to talk again if you're open to that as well, because there's so much. The interest with me was the relationship between feeling like that whatever that was previously, when it wasn't there, just feeling too exposed publicly, that it manifested as paranoia. This is old stuff that came back. But I just felt I was out in the world and I was like, I don't have protection. Like I felt like I didn't have protection. So it felt like now I'm rebuilding like my social skills or my social mask in a healthy way. And I think the point I guess I'm indirectly going to is that, and you mentioned this near the beginning, the persona when adaptive is necessary. But we can link the persona with being inauthentic, and there's a whole movement against being inauthentic. So it can be,
What does
just
authenticity mean anyway? I'm
what does
like,
it exactly?
is it showing giving everybody a backstage pass to your life? No.
And of course, you're going to be different in different contexts and with different people. So if you were like this also this idea of always being the same, always being authentic in any situation, like you're not, it's a bit misguided.
Well, I think this is why Jung talked, and Murray Stein, who you interviewed, sort of touched on numinosity, that having a numinous experience can really be very reorganizing for us. But we need support after the fact. So, numinous experiences can be dreadful, not just like feel good. So, trying to figure out like kind of reorganize ourselves existentially after something like that happens, or after your psychosis can, you know, that I'm sure it's just takes time to, and also I think sometimes numinous experiences, really challenge our self-care system quite abruptly sometimes, and not having that self-care system as a protector, right? Self-care system is meant to protect us, and it often relates this archetypal energy that is a protecting force, so that the self can be sequestered somewhere. But a numinous experience, or a psychotic experience, you could say, kind of breaks right through to the self sometimes.
Would you say psychedelic as well? Like a psychedelic experience?
I'm
You've got
so
one
mad.
minute. Or no, our time's up. Damn
Oh, shit. Okay. Well, psychedelic
it.
experiences, yes and no. I think sometimes people try to determine what their psychedelic experiences are for. I just am really skeptical of people using them recreationally and not having the support for integration afterwards.
Yeah.
And also just friggin', if you're habitually doing psychedelics, but you're not doing depth-based psychodynamic work, I'm kind of like, huh. Yeah.
Tricky territory, isn't it, to say the least?
It really is, yeah. And I work with people who offer this as medicine with their clients. Yeah. But respect for the medicine is really important, and understanding it and having a really deep reverence for the medicine over a period of time by having been adequately taught and led by other people, and really, doing the years of work it would take to be able to offer that to other people responsibly. And I think it can do wonders for people, absolutely, and change people's lives. But it needs to happen for me in tandem with deep spiritual guidance. And as Murray Stein said in his interview, like, you have to still go deal with the problems of your life.
As
So,
tempting as it is to disappear into the archetypal realm. Yeah,
yeah.
there's a balance.
Disappearing into the archetypal realm could also be called a spiritual bypass. Right. So,
Or madness. Jane, it's time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
yeah, so
So
fun
much fun.
chatting with you.
Yeah, it feels so good talking with you around these topics that I've like meditated on for a while. And I'm sure that people listening will get so much value as well from the conversation.
And talk to me in 2 years. I might say something different because of that kind of commitment to learning and questioning, and it might sound a little different. So I just want to kind of make sure folks know that this isn't, this is my, these are my thoughts, but just like you have your own journey through your own process, Ricky, like, I don't know. No people's like soul paths. I can't say for other people, but just some of my thoughts today.
Well, they're very much welcome, and I'm sure we'll give a lot of value to a lot of people that tune in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERISZ.